This is a special edition of Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're going to remember the great Ray Charles, who has died at the age of 73 from complications of liver disease. We'll listen back to an interview with Charles, and we'll hear from two musicians who worked with him, Quincy Jones and Hank Crawford. Ray Charles virtually invented soul music. Music critic Peter Guralnick writes, quote, "It's hard to imagine the impact his record I Got a Woman had in 1954 and 55 for blacks and whites, for a young Elvis and an only slightly older Sam Cooke. The very stratagem of adapting a traditional gospel song, putting secular lyrics to it, and then delivering it with all the attendant fanfare of a Pentecostal service was, simply, staggering. For the next 10 years, his success was without artistic or commercial parallel," unquote. Ray Charles was nicknamed the genius, and it wasn't just his style of singing that set him apart. It was also his piano playing, arranging, and his choice of songs, jazz, pop, and country, as well as soul music. I spoke with Ray Charles in 1998, after the release of a box set collecting his complete country and western recordings from 1959 to 86. It included his 1962 version of Your Cheatin' Heart.
Your cheatin' heart will make try to sleep, but sleep won't come the whole night through. Your cheating heart will tell on you when tears come down.
This is just a really wonderful example of you doing a song your way. I mean, the
you
might even be using different chords on here than the chords that were written. But
the,
you know,
that's right. That's right. Well, that's that's what makes it become me.
Uh huh. And the singing, too, of course.
Well, thank you, ma'am.
But would you say a little bit about what you did with this song to make it your own?
Well, it's like any song that I'm going to do. I first sing it to myself and see if I can genuinely feel it, you know. Any song, I'm that way about all music, all songs I do. I sit there maybe sometimes I may sit at the keyboard and fool around with the chords and see if I can find a way to sing it where it makes me feel good inside. And sometimes, you know, I can run into songs that are good songs, but I can't make it do anything for me. But the song is a great song, you know. To give you for an example, like, I've always loved Stardust, a beautiful song, but I never could quite get it to sound like I wanted it to for me. So, you know, it's really a true feeling what you feel inside, you know, where you can put yourself into it. Can you really feel what you're doing? And that's important to me, to feel what I'm doing.
Okay, now Stardust, you had a huge hit with Hoagy Carmichael's Georgia.
That's right.
How come Stardust doesn't work for you?
Well, I just could never get into it. I mean, Georgia was something, I used to harm Georgia. As a matter of fact, my chauffeur, you said to me one day, he said, "You know, Mr. Charles, you're always humming that song, George. You're always humming it all the time. Why don't you record it?" Well, I had never thought about recording. I just liked the song, you know. But it was a chord structure in Georgia. I mean, especially in the middle part of it, it's got some beautiful changes to it. Hoagy Carmichael, I have to give him some skin. He wrote some beautiful stuff on that song. Georgia, Georgia, the whole day through, just an old sweet song
keeps Georgia on my mind.
Georgia on my mind.
I said, Georgia, Georgia, a song of you comes as sweet and clear as moonlight through the pines. Other arms reach out to me, other eyes smile tenderly. Still in the peaceful dreams I see, the road leads back to you. I said, Georgia.
Now, your biography back from, I think, 1978 Georgia begins, let me say, right here and now, that I am a country boy, and man, I mean the real backwoods. Tell us a little bit about where you grew up in the country.
Oh, well, I'm from a little small town in, well, actually, I was born in Albany, Georgia, but I don't know anything about it because my parents moved to Florida when I was about 6 months old, so, you know, I wouldn't remember anything. So I was raised in a little village, I guess you could call it, called Greenville, Florida. It's about 42 miles east of Tallahassee, you know, and it was just a little country town, and we just had like a little general store, and there was a post office, and there was a bus stop, not a bus station, but you know, where you sit on the bench and wait for the bus, and that was about it, and everybody knew everybody, and you know, and of course I'd say the bulk of the people were people that were more or less poor, you know. But so if Miss Jones needed some sugar, she would borrow it from my mom, and if my mom needed some flour, she would borrow it from Miss Williams or whatever. I mean, that's the way we got along.
And what did you hear on the radio then?
Well, basically, in the daytime, you heard country music on the radio. I mean, that was it. All day long was country music all over the dial. And at night, you could hear things like Benny Goodman or Tommy Dorsey or Count Basie, because they would have, in those days, they had programs that were live that was coming from some of the various hotels and nightclubs. And so you could hear various bands at night, and in the daytime, you heard strictly the country music. And, of course, being in a black neighborhood, naturally, I heard the blues. I mean, that's where the blues was. And, of course, the religion thing, because, you know, you went to revival meetings and BYPU, and I went to Sunday school and church and on Sunday morning and Sunday evenings. And so, you know, that was the mixture that I grew up in.
Now, I know a lot of African-American musicians grew up listening to country music on the radio in the South, because that's what was on the radio.
Yeah.
Then. I'm wondering if you ever felt any more distance from that music because the performers were white and you were African-American. Did that matter to you at all?
No. You know, that is the marvelous thing about music. It is the one thing that I won't say there was no segregation or anything. I'm not saying that, but it was very, very small. I mean, if you look around, you saw guys like Benny Goodman. I mean, there was Lyle Hampton in his band. You know, various white bands. There were black people in the bands, and there was when I was coming up, I even worked with a hillbilly group in Florida called the Hillbilly Playboys, the Florida Playboys, and it was a hillbilly group. They taught me how to yodel.
Yeah, no, could you yodel for us?
Yodel. I mean, I'm a lot better than that, but that's the idea. Yodel. My voice is too early in the morning, but you get the idea.
You know, I have to say that is not unlike some of the things that you do on your soul records. No, really.
Okay.
Did you think I was nuts when I said that about yodeling sounding not unlike some of the things you do on your soul records?
Yeah. No. I heard every word of it, girl. I really did.
We're listening back to a 1998 interview with Ray Charles. We'll continue the interview after a break. This is a special edition of Fresh Air. We're remembering Ray Charles, who has died at the age of 73. Let's get back to the 1998 interview I recorded with him.
Now, it's funny, you know, when I was young, some of your country songs were really big hits, you know, like Born to Lose and You Don't Know Me and Crying Time. I didn't think of them as country songs. I thought of them as Ray Charles records.
You're very sweet, honey. Thank you, Terry.
I mean that. I didn't find out till much later they were country songs.
Well, actually, what it is, I'll tell you something that I mean, and which I think it would be helpful to the people, to our listeners. You see, just so they will really know what I'm about. You see, I am not a country singer. I'm not a jazz singer. I am not a blues singer. What I am is I am a singer that can sing country music. I can sing the blues. I can sing a love song, but I'm not a specialist. You know what I mean? I'm kind of like a baseball player. You know, I can play a little first base, second base, shortstop, and third base. I might can catch and pitch a little bit for you if you need me to. I'm sort of like that in the music world, as opposed to being, say, a specialist. Like you would say, B.B. King is a blues singer.
Right.
There's no question about it. But I'm not a blues singer. I'm a singer that can sing the blues.
I want to play another personal favorite from your country recordings, and this is You Don't Know Me. Would you tell us about why you chose this song?
Oh, I think again the songs that I choose. I start with the lyrics. What are the lyrics saying to me? What kind of story are they telling me? You know, it's like an actor who looks at a script. You know, because you know when you look at lyrics, you know you gotta tell a story in 3 minutes. You know, you don't have 2 hours like you do when you got a script. You got to say what you got to say and make it believable within 3 minutes. So I start with the lyrics, you know. And when I start with the lyrics, I tell myself, now how many people will this song fit? I mean, does it sound like most people can relate to it? And you tell yourself, yeah, you give your hand to me, and then you say, I watch you walk away, you know. If you can see, or you when you hear somebody says, I can't stop loving you, I made up my mind. Just think of the people say that, you know. And so I always start with the lyrics to see, does the lyrics carry any real meaning, not just for me, but for the people who are going to be listening to me?
Well, let's hear You Don't Know Me, and the song was written by Cindy Walker and Eddie Arnold, and this is Ray Charles' 1962 recording of it, now reissued on his CD box set, The Complete Country and Western Recordings, 1959 to 1986.
You give your hand to me, and then you say hello. And I can hardly speak. My heart is beating so, and anyone can tell. You think you know me well, but you don't know me.
No, you don't know me.
No, you don't know the one who dreams of you at night and longs to kiss your lips and longs to hold you tight. Oh, I'm just a friend. That's all I've ever been. 'Cause you don't know me.
No, you don't know me.
For I never knew the art of making love. Though my heart.
As we mentioned, you grew up in the country. And I think it was at about the age of 7 that you lost your sight, and you lost it gradually over a period of a couple of years. Did you realize what was happening?
Well, as far as losing my sight, I knew that because my mom was very astute. I mean, I don't know how she managed to come up with the idea she did, you know, but see, because she didn't have no psychologist to tell her to do this or tell her to do that. But she knew I was going to lose my eyesight. And so since she knew I was going to lose my sight, she started, showing me how to get around and how to do things without seeing. Like she would tell me, okay, I'm going to show you where this chair is. Okay, now since you can't see that chair, you're going to have to teach yourself to remember that that chair is there. Or you got to teach yourself to remember that that table is there. Or you got to teach yourself to remember to turn right when you get to da 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 da. And of course, she started with me with me when I started to lose my eyesight. So I gained an awful lot. And of course, being that age, it wasn't as much of a shock as, say, it would be if I was, say, losing my sight at the age of 30 or 40 or something where you've seen all your life.
Did you go through a long period of depression afterwards?
No, because by the time I started losing my sight for sure, I was going to a school for the deaf and the blind. And, you know, children, you know, I'm sure you're aware of this, but children can be very brutal. I mean, to each other.
Yeah, no kidding, yeah.
You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And so if you go in there, like when I first went there, I was very homesick and I was crying. And you know what you go through, because where I went to school was about 130 or 40 miles from where I live, you know. So there was a state school for the blind and deaf, as I say. So I was crying and missing my mom and all that. And see, kids, instead of sympathizing with, they would pick on you and make you feel bad, you know, so you know, they'll get you out of that kind of groove.
Did you have good medical care at the time?
Oh, no, honey, you know, you're thinking about much later in life. I mean, I bless your heart. I appreciate the question, but no, medically. I mean, I don't think anybody in those days even knew what that was.
Right.
As a matter of fact, we had one hospital on the campus, and you won't believe this, but this is the facts. It was one hospital there, and it was on what they called the white side. It was not. We had to go over to the white side if we needed to go to the hospital. I mean, that was just the way it was. Nobody thought nothing about it because, hey, if that's the way it is, that's the way it is.
Well, it's kind of amazing, isn't it, that here you are going to school for people who are blind, and it's a segregated school.
That's
so
right.
You're segregated by color, which you can't even see.
That's right. That's right. But, you know, I'm sure you probably will never understand it, because I never understood, and I've lived a lot longer than you, and I can tell you, I've never understood how somebody can be against me and yet let me cook their food for them, feed them. You know, don't make sense, does it?
Your mother must have been pretty determined to have you in the school. I mean, considering that she was pretty poor, that you lived in a backwoods area, to manage to get you to this school and maybe even force you to go because you probably wanted to stay home, mm-hmm. That was pretty good on her part.
Oh, yeah. Well, as I said, she's very foresighted. I'll always love my mom when I stop to think about the things that she, you know, she really is responsible for me being what I am today, because she instilled in me that it was vital that I be independent. It was vital because she would always tell me, even people who love you, your friends, you know, you need to do things for yourself, because, I mean, there are times when they're busy, when they might want to do it for you, but they don't have the time, and you need to know how to do things for yourself, take care of yourself. And she did her best to teach me every little bitty thing that she thought would be helpful to me in my life. Therefore, I know how to clean up a house. I know how to cook. I know how to wash clothes. You know, I know how to do things. That's why people are so surprised when they see me packing my bags. They say, "You mean you pack your own bags?" I say, "Yeah, well, even if somebody else pack them, I have to tell them how to do it."
Was it at the boarding school for children who were blind and deaf that you first learned to play music?
Exactly. Yeah, I couldn't get into piano class, so I started taking up clarinet. That's why I can play clarinet and saxophone.
Wait, so you played clarinet first?
Oh, yeah.
How'd you
mm-hmm.
like the instrument?
I loved it. Well, I was a great fan of Artie Shaw. I used to love him. Everybody was talking about Benny Goodman, but I was an Artie Shaw man. I mean, 100%. And I was very impressed by what he could do with a clarinet. And naturally, he was my mentor. I wanted to play. But I wanted to be in the piano class. But since I couldn't, I figured, well, okay, I'll play clarinet. And I did that. And of course, but the next year, I was able to get into the piano class.
Did you give up clarinet?
No, I studied both. I kept studying both instruments, but naturally my heart was with the keyboard, because I mean that's just, because there's so much you can do when you play piano. I by the time I was 12 years old, 13 years old, I could write a whole arrangement for a 17-piece band. See, that's the great thing. If you study piano, it gives you a whole outlook on a lot of different things that has to do with music.
Ray Charles recorded in 1998. We'll hear more of the interview in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and we're remembering Ray Charles on this special edition of Fresh Air. This is a special edition of Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're remembering Ray Charles, who has died at the age of 73. Let's get back to the interview I recorded with Charles in 1998 after the release of a box set collecting his complete country and western recordings from 1959 to 86. When we left off, we were talking about the School for the Blind, where he learned to play piano.
Now, how old were you when you left school and set off on your own?
I was about 15 when my mom died. So I left school that year.
And what was it like for you to first be on your own like that?
Oh, it was tough. But I was lucky. I mean, I was lucky because my mom had a friend that lived in Jacksonville, which, as I say, was about 100-some-odd miles from Greenville. And my mom had always talked to me about her and told me that, you know, if I ever needed someone to talk to, this lady and her were very good friends. And so when my mom passed away, I fooled around for a little while in Greenville and Tallahassee, and then I decided I would go to Jacksonville, because Jacksonville was a city, and I wanted to see if I could, you know, get started in music and do something. So I went there, and this lady's name was Lena Mae Thompson, and her husband Fred Thompson, they took me in and treated me just like I was their own kid. They fed me, because I sure didn't have no money, didn't have nothing. They bought me clothes. I mean, I was lucky, you know, and when I would get a job, maybe once or twice a week or something like that, I'd give them the money, you know, because, I mean, it wasn't that much money involved in the first place, and I know they spent way more money than I was able to give them back.
Now, what were the early kinds of places you performed in?
Oh, they were like places, one way in and one way out, you know what I mean? They were places like it was like dance halls, and they would, and a lot of them would sell beer, and they'd sell fish and chicken and stuff like that. But like I said, it was one way in, one way out. So if a fight broke out, you know, it was kind of rough. Those were the days. I have to say that they were good experiences, but I would not like to do them again. You know, because like I said, we were playing dances in those days, and of course, anything could happen.
Now, early in your career, you went through a period, like many people do early on, of trying to figure out who you were musically. And before you really figured that out, you sounded very much like you had patterned yourself on Nat Cole and Charles Brown.
That's right.
What did they both mean to you? Why did you feel so strongly about them?
I just love the way... Well, Nat Cole, the reason he was so powerful in my life was the fact that I wanted to do exactly what he was doing. Most people think of Nat Cole as a great singer, you know, they know his voice. But I was looking at Nat Cole as a pianist. I mean, he was one of the, people don't realize, but Nat Cole was a hell of a pianist. He played some of that tasty stuff behind his singing. And that's what I wanted to do, was to be able to play little tasty things behind what I was singing. So I really tried to pattern myself after Nat Cole in the early beginnings of my career.
And Charles Brown, the rhythm and blues.
And Charles Brown had that real. I don't know how you would call it. He had that. He always sounded like he was pleading, begging. You know, really pleading in his songs or crying. You know, and I like that. He always sounded like he was sincere. Whatever he was singing about, he was genuine. He meant it. That's the way I took Charles Brown, and I liked it, especially when he was singing the blues or something like Merry Christmas, Baby, and stuff like that.
Well, I thought we could listen to the very first recording that you made, which is Confession Blues.
Oh, my goodness. Where did you find that?
On one of your box sets. It was easy.
Oh, brother. Yeah, that's one of the things where I was, you got me down pat. I was about 17 years old at that time when I made that.
This is 1949. Let's hear it, and then we'll talk about it.
I want to tell you a story. Of a boy who was once in love. I want to tell you a story. Of a boy who was once in love. How the girl that I loved robbed me of the happiness I dreamed of. She called me fine, sweet, and mellow, but that didn't mean a thing.
That was Ray Charles' first recording, made in 1949. How did you start to get a sense of who you were as a singer and start to establish your own sound?
Oh, well, around about 19... Well, I started thinking about it in the 1951, somewhere in there, in 1950 or 51. But I was scared to try it because, I could get a lot of work sounding like Nat Cole. You know, I could work in nightclubs and I could make a living, with his sound. You know, I could take the amplifier and tune it and add a little bass and a little bit of treble or something like that to it and sound pretty close, almost just like it, you know. But then I knew what I woke up one morning. And I started to thinking that I said to myself, nobody knows my name. Everybody said to me, hey, kid, you sound just like Nat Cole. Hey, kid. It was always, hey, kid. Nobody never said Ray. Never, never, never. So I started telling myself, your mom always told you to be yourself. And you got to be yourself if you're going to make it in this business. I know you love Nat Cole, but you got to stop that. You know, it was just a question of thinking one morning when I woke up, people don't even know my name. I'm just Hey Kid.
We're listening to a 1998 interview with Ray Charles. We'll play the final part of the interview, and we'll hear from two musicians who worked with Ray Charles, Quincy Jones and Hank Crawford, after a break. This is a special edition of Fresh Air. Before we get back to the final part of our 1998 interview with Ray Charles, we're going to hear from two people who worked with him, Quincy Jones and Hank Crawford. Upon hearing of Charles's death, Quincy Jones said, quote, "Ray Charles was my oldest friend, my brother in every sense of the word," unquote. Ray Charles was one of the first musicians that Quincy Jones became good friends with. They met when Charles was 16 and Jones was 14. In 2001, Quincy Jones told me how they met.
I think it was at the Elks Club, Terry, where we used to, after we played two jobs, we'd work from 7 to 10 in the white tennis clubs and where we'd play cup music of the popular music of the day, To Each His Own and Room Full of Roses. And then at 10 o'clock, we'd go play the black clubs, the Black and Tan, the Rockin' Chair, and the Washington Educational and Social Club. And we'd play for strippers, and we sang.
Oh, really?
We had choreography. We had everything. As kids, we were pretty cocky because we had a great, great band. We could read music very well. And we did everything. It was a show band, too. So we got most of the jobs that that came around. It was nice. We played with Billie Holiday when we were in 48, behind her. And then in 49, we played with Billy Eckstine and Cab Calloway and all the bands that came through. So we were pretty confident in those days. The band just kept getting tighter because we rehearsed a lot.
You said that you admired Ray Charles' independence. He was 16 years old. He was blind, but he had his own apartment. He got around town himself. He had a girlfriend. I mean, he had a lot of things that you wanted.
Yes, he did. He had his own apartment, too, in two suits. It was amazing. And what impressed me the most with Ray is that he was so independent, and his sightlessness did not hinder him at all. It's one of the cherished friendships that I really have, because as kids we used to talk about everything. He'd show me how to write music in Braille, Dizzy Gillespie songs like Eminem and Bebop, etc. And we used to dream about the future. Like, wouldn't it be great to work with a symphony orchestra? One day we're going to do that. One day we're going to have three girlfriends each, you know. One day we're going to do movies together. We're going to do all of that stuff. And we did it. That's what's amazing. We did, you know, In the Heat of the Night together. And we did We the World, all of those things. Everything, the girls. So we did. It's amazing to dream and have your dreams executed like that.
I thought I'd play a 1959 recording that you arranged for Ray Charles, and this is from the Genius of Ray Charles album, which was recorded in 1959. We're going to hear "Let the Good Times Roll." Would you like to say anything about this track?
I would just like to add that we had half of Count Basie's band on that session and half of Duke Ellington's band on that session. And in those days, that's when I first started to work with Phil Ramone, the engineer, who's now a producer. And Ahmet Erdogan, Neshiwe Erdogan, and Jerry Wexler came by, because in those days, what you heard was what you got. It wasn't about fixing in the mix. There was nothing to mix. So because it was mono, and we went in the booth to listen to a playback of that tune. I remember this very vividly. When it was playing back, I said, "What's that, Phil?" And he said that there was something coming out of the left speaker and different thing coming out of the right speaker. He said it's called stereophonic sound. Never forgot it, because I'd heard it earlier in Portland, what on earphones, and it was called binaural sound by the man that invented stereo.
This is Ray Charles, arrangement by Quincy Jones. "Let the Good Times Roll."
And when you're dead, you're done. So let the good time roll. I say let the good time roll. I don't care if you're young or old. You ought to get together and let the good time roll. Don't sit there mumbling, talking trash. If you want to have a ball, you got to go out and spend some cash and let the good time roll now. I'm talking about the good times. Well, it makes no difference whether you're young or old. All you got to do is get together and let the good time roll.
Our interview with Quincy Jones was recorded in 2001. In 1998, I talked about Ray Charles with Hank Crawford, who was Charles's music director in the late 50s and early 60s and played alto and baritone saxophones in the band. Crawford was a student in Nashville when he first met Ray Charles. Crawford had heard that Ray Charles was about to perform in Nashville, but Charles's baritone player had just left, so he was looking for another one. At the suggestion of Crawford's friends, he decided to show up with a baritone.
I never played baritone in my life. But I was excited because it was Ray Charles, and I'd heard a couple of his records. I think it was Drowning My Own Tears and Hallelujah, Love Us So. So I jumped at the opportunity, even if it had to be on baritone saxophone, an instrument which is bigger than me. I'm not such a large person, you know. But I did get the saxophone. I went down, and I played the job that night.
Brains a tear, I know, oh, to my eyes when I begin. So much well since you've been gone, oh, did you know? I know I'm almost drowning. And I say, oh, oh, I'm gonna sit and cry now.
So Ray Charles eventually appointed you music director. What did that mean? What were your responsibilities?
I was in charge of the band. I was arranger. And arranging music, making notations for Ray. I think I got the job because I had majored in music theory and composition. So I was doing a bit of writing and composing at the time and working with Ray because he was writing. He's a heck of an arranger himself.
When you were arranging music with Ray Charles, what would he communicate to you about what he wanted to hear?
He would just walk around. I'd go to his house, you know, and at his home. And we'd go down into the den, and he'd say, we're going to write this today, and tell me how many sheets of paper and what instruments we were going to write for. And I would prepare that, and he would come in, and he'd say, well, we're going to do the first trumpet part. And he would call the notes, you know, and I would write things down. Like I say, he would dictate the notes, and I would, you know, notate them.
When you say dictate it, would he, like, play it at the piano? Is that the kind of dictation it was?
You know, he never used the piano doing this, like most arrangers do. But he would just walk around and call the notes, you know. I guess he...
You don't mean he'd hum it. You mean he'd say A flat?
No, he would. No, he. Yeah, he. Yeah, he would say a quarter rest, 2/16 notes B and C. You know, then half rest, and he'd say that should end the bar. I said yes, and he said next bar, 2/32 or whatever. You know, it'd go like that, and he'd call the notes.
Shoes. Can't even win a nickel bet because of them that's got, them that gets, and I ain't got nothing yet. I'm sneaking in and out, ducking my landlord. All I seem to do is stay in debt because of them that's got, yeah, them that gets. And I tell y'all, I ain't got nothing yet. That old saying, them that's got or them that gets, is something I can't see. If you gotta have something before you can get something, how do you get your first is still a mystery to me. I see folk with long cars and fine clothes. That's why they're called the smarter set, because they manage to get when only them that's got supposed to get, and I ain't got nothing yet.
Our interview with Hank Crawford was recorded in 1998. We'll hear the conclusion of our interview with Ray Charles after a break. This is a special edition of Fresh Air. We're remembering Ray Charles. Let's hear the final part of the interview we recorded with him in 1998. Your sound, you know, draws on rhythm and blues and also, I think, gospel music. Did you sing in a church when you were young?
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah, like I said to you earlier, I went to all the BYPU meetings and the Sunday school and the Sunday morning service and the evening service and the revival meetings they would have during the week. You know, whenever that was going on, I didn't star in the church, but I did sing, a little bit in the choir.
Is there a record that you think of as being the first recording that you made as yourself, really establishing yourself?
Probably I Got a Woman. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was it. Because that when I did that, that seemed to upset a lot of people. But it was really me.
It upset really, a lot of people?
Oh, yeah, a lot of people thought that it was too religious and I was bastardizing the church. And, oh, man, I got all kinds of criticism.
Oh, you mean you were using too much of a sanctified sound for a sexual record?
Yeah, that's right. But it was really me. It was 100% me. And, of course, I just said, well, I have to be criticized because I'm going to sing the way I sing. And later on, after some other people start doing it, then they start calling it soul music. It just goes to show you, I guess I was a little ahead of my time or something.
Well, I think that's inarguable. Why don't we hear I Got a Woman? And this is my guest, Ray Charles.
Well, I got a woman way over town that's good to me. Oh, yeah. Say, I got a woman way over town, good to me. Oh, yeah, she give me money when I'm in need. Yeah, she's a kind of friend indeed. I got a woman way over town that's good to me. Oh, yeah, she says loving early in the morning just for me.
That's Ray Charles, the recording that he said was the first one that really sounded like his own style. The record that we just heard, I Got a Woman, was one of your early recordings for Atlantic.
Yes.
When you started recording for Atlantic, what was it like for you to find your audience?
Oh, it was very... Atlantic was a great company, babe. I have to tell you, for me, now I'm only speaking for myself because I know some people will say, oh, man, boom, Ray, you're wrong. But for me, it was a great company because what Atlantic did, they were smart in the sense that they never, ever tried to sway me in any way, form, shape, or fashion as to what should I do when it comes to music. All they did was... whenever I wanted to record, wherever I wanted to record, they would come and pay the bill. That's all they would do. And it left me open to record, wherein like a lot of kids today, they have producers and they got to record what the producers say. And the producer says, I want you to sound like who had the last hit. So you don't have, when I was coming up, I didn't have no pressure. I could just, Atlantic said, hey, you might not have a hit now, but you're going to have a hit. And it was true because I made 3 or 4 records for Atlantic before, you know, they didn't do anything. But then we came up with a song called Doing the Mess Around, which was a big hit. It Should Have Been Me. And next thing we had, I Got a Woman. So, but the first 2 or 3 records I made didn't sell. But you can't do that in today's age. You make 2 or 3 records that don't sell now and you're out.
I'd like to end our interview by asking you to choose a favorite, if you have one, from the new country music box set. There's a big selection there.
That's true. And it'd be very hard to find what I'd call a favorite, but I can tell you one of the songs that I really love. There's an old Johnny Cash thing that I did on that called Ring of Fire, but I got it from Johnny Cash. I think it'd be real nice to play that Ring of Fire.
I love that song, and it was written by his wife, June.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Oh, no kidding. Uh-huh. Oh, well, thank you for telling me that.
So we'll end with Ring of Fire. Why do you love the song?
Well, just think of the lyrics. Just think of the lyrics. Oh, love is a burning thing. You know, oh, it talks, babe. It speaks to you, you know. I really didn't know what you just told me, but boy, I have to say, I'm very happy to hear that.
Well, Ray Charles, it has been so wonderful to talk with you. I really thank you so much for your time.
Well, Terry, it's been good talking to you, and I just want you to know not only is it good to talk to you, but I'm going to keep on listening to you, too.
It is an honor to hear you say that. Thank you.
I really mean it. Thank you very much.
Ray Charles recorded in 1998. He spoke to us from his own studio, which was recently declared a Los Angeles City landmark. Ray Charles died Thursday at the age of 73.